bringing us back in Stevie Ray Vaughan. Yeah.
Woo!
You got it, Matt. Light it up, Stevie. Joining us on the phone from Fort Myers, it's Rob.
Is that like World News Tonight or something? What was that noise?
That's not exactly what I was thinking, but you know, whatever fantasy works for you.
I'd like to be Dan Rather, although his career hasn't been the best in the last 2 years.
Don't be picking on Dan Rather on this show, my friend.
Hello, this is Dan Rather, and you're listening to Crosswinds with Carl Zahn at 1590 WSMN, Nashua's news and talk. He's a good guy, and besides that, he's a local boy. Tune him in.
Thanks, Dan. Okay, thanks, Rob.
Hey, big news this week in South Carolina, huh?
What was the big news?
The big news, McCain took it last night.
Oh, I thought there was probably something else, some kind of bestiality headline or something.
Twister.
Down there. Twister. There you go. Yeah, McCain took it. So what do you think? Are you coming over? You coming over to my side?
He is, without a doubt, the best candidate. And yeah, I am a big supporter of McCain.
Still haven't answered the question, Rob.
I'm going to ditch your question until the last minute. You're going to strangle me, but that's the way it's going to be.
Okay. What do you got down there? What else you got for me?
Well, they tried to derail him this week. At one of his rallies, a guy stood up and asked him if he had changed his mind opposing the flying of the Confederate flag on the South Carolina State House. Did you see that?
I did see that.
He handled it pretty good. You know, he had lost South Carolina once, but he stood by his guns. He said he was proud to support the majority of the people of South Carolina who wanted it removed.
I thought it was a great response, and this is why you have to love McCain. He just doesn't care about the political fallout. He's going to tell it like it is. And, he did it in Michigan, and it cost him some votes there. But just telling them, you know what, those auto jobs are not coming back.
Yep.
You know, thank God Romney's going to take care of that so they don't have anything to worry about in Michigan.
Exactly. In stark contrast, you know, Mitt Romney, pandering for last-minute votes, pledged to paint the Confederate flag across the entire north elevation of the White House.
I have, I was so proud of his response, I had the Confederate flag tattooed on my left butt cheek yesterday.
Nice.
Thanks, Matt.
Nice.
Something.
And I'm sure you don't know this, but I was watching the news this morning because Giuliani has been counting on Florida. Do you know how much he's been counting on Florida?
Well, it was a very risky game plan that he had. Yeah, Florida was his firewall, and it's not looking too good.
No. I mean, I'm from Florida. I'm here now, and he's been campaigning a little, but not a lot. And today, in a press conference, he says that the overwhelming majority of the people in the United States have said they want change. They want to change the direction of this country, and he said that this country doesn't need a change of direction. It just needs a change of leadership. And I disagree with him. The country isn't going in a good direction.
Yeah, it needs more than change. It's like we had a caller last week, Joe from Florida, and we need a complete overhaul of Congress. I think he's right. Listen, I'm gonna cut you loose early here so we can replay our O'Reilly interview in this segment. Are your feelings going to be hurt?
No, go ahead.
No, okay.
I got my stuff out. I'll bring you a report next week.
I got my stuff out. I'm not even going near that. Okay, that was that was Rob from Fort Myers, Florida, folks. Okay, we're gonna jump right in. This is my interview with Bill O'Reilly, done here at the studio on January 11th. Take it away. Bill, thanks very much for giving me a few minutes. You are my mentor, as you know. I hold you in high esteem and even higher now after seeing you reposition that staffer at the Obama rally up here.
Yeah, I'm sorry I had to do that, but, as a lot of people saw and heard, this guy was trying to block Fox News from getting a shot at the senator when we were legitimately entitled to do so. And he wouldn't listen to reason, so I had to gently remove him, Carl. You know, in the great tradition of live free or die.
Live free or die. It's an O'Reilly classic. You did the right thing. You gave the guy several opportunities in a polite way.
I saw
it on your TV show. He was obviously, moving over, blocking your shot. You did the right thing. No problem
Thank
here.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
First of all, the Fox News debate last night, the buzz is that Fred Thompson, who did appear awake and alert for the first time in his campaign, was the winner. Did we break any new ground last night?
You know, I think Thompson helped himself a lot. He's off the ropes. I don't know if it's going to translate into anything but a few points in South Carolina, but it just makes the whole thing more interesting. You know, he was down, he was out, nobody was paying attention. He comes back in a national debate, he shows some life, he gets some liners off, and all of that is good. So I'm one of these guys that say the more people out there that the folks can hear, their points of view makes everybody better. And so I thought the debate last night went well.
I think it was one of the best debates to date, as a matter of fact. Moving on, as a, you know, I'm a New Hampshire native, so I admit my bias, and we're really fortunate for political junkies like me. You know, our involvement up here is it's unrivaled. You know, last Friday I went to Closet to get a shirt, and Ron Paul was standing there. There's there's a candidate in every corner.
Right.
But what do you think? We always take the heat. We're not diverse enough, New Hampshire. We're not representative of the rest of the country, and it's not fair. What's your take?
Well, I don't buy that. I mean, each state is unique. Each state is different. And Iowa, you have a heavy far-left component, heavy evangelical component in their caucus. I think New Hampshire is a solid working-class state. Not many people of color. That throws the demographic off a little bit. But then you go South Carolina, where you have a 30% African-American demographic in the Democratic primary, as opposed to 13% of African-Americans' total population. So I think it all balances out. And I like to see states like New Hampshire and Iowa get attention and have the real folks matter and get enthused. I think it jazzes the whole country.
Well, good. I'm glad you feel that way, because people do take it seriously up here. And
Obama,
Obama did great, 110,000-plus votes. He's got nothing to be ashamed of. Now, if I can get a little Dennis Miller-esque here for a minute, I can't remember a race as fluid as this one. And part of the country seems to be behaving like a recently divorced spouse with a substance abuse problem. You know, we're falling in love with the first candidate to come along. We're falling for the flowery talk, the crocodile tears. Is there any way to predict where we're going to be on February 6th?
You know, if I had to bet right now, I say Hillary Clinton is probably going to win the Democratic nomination. But Obama, as you pointed out, Carl, has really given her a good run. But I think the Clinton machine, as we saw in New Hampshire, kicks in and makes it very, very tough for the new kid on the block. Wouldn't be surprised to see Obama get the VP nomination with Clinton. So it'd be a Clinton-Obama ticket. On the Republican side, you just can't. It's just impossible.
That's what I think.
Yeah, there's just no way. And anybody who thinks they know is crazy. Romney could come back in Michigan. Thompson, as we discussed, could come back in South Carolina. Giuliani could come back in Florida. I mean, it is just all over the place. So it makes it exciting.
Yeah, okay. And then quickly, a couple more, I'll wrap up and let you go. In the interest of full disclosure, you know, I've been a staunch McCain supporter since 2000. I've forgiven him for his legislative transgressions. The trust and character issue was big for me. I believe he'll tap Lieberman for VP, but that's just a long shot. You know, that's just a guess. But never mind reaching across the aisle, which we know he can do. Can he get the unity he needs on his side of the aisle?
Well, I think that if you have a race where John McCain is running against Hillary Clinton, that you'll have most Republicans turn out for McCain.
Okay.
I mean, I don't see Republicans staying home or crossing over. I mean, they don't like McCain's immigration situation. I think he's understood that, and now he's toughening that up. So I expect if he gets the nomination, he'll be much tougher on a security at the border than he was. That was what really teed people off about McCain.
Oh, absolutely. I've had some heated conversations up here trying to make my case for him.
But I expect him to be smart enough to do that without, you know, demonizing illegal alien workers, law-abiding people who don't cause trouble and just trying to make a buck. I don't think he'll ever do that, but I think he'll clamp down and say, look. So, you know, if McCain runs against Clinton, it'll be a classic Republican-Democrat slugout. It'll almost be a rerun of Bush-Kerry. Classic. If Obama gets in there, or, you know, say a Huckabee gets in there, then it's going to be totally different than ever before. So you've got the traditional people, and then you've got the new people and we'll see how it shakes down.
Okay, and finally, last thing here. If Billary does a remake of Tracks of My Tears, and it turns out that those tracks lead from the snowbanks of New Hampshire to the Capitol, how does the country look in 2012?
Well, I don't fear Hillary Clinton in the White House. I mean, I think she'll raise taxes, and, you know, I have enough money myself, but I feel sorry for people who don't, because once you start to do that, the economy is going to wobble, but it's wobbling now.
Yeah, I might be sleeping on your couch in 2012,
yeah, you know,
would be the main difference.
That's the problem with the Democratic platform, is that they want to raise taxes across the board, they want to up the spending ante. And the country just, I don't think, can compete at that level with the other countries in the world. So,
listen,
but I don't fear her. I don't think she's, you know, a nut or anything. But obviously, we're going to watch and see what she does.
Well, it's going to be very interesting. Listen, I'm sure if you're like me after last weekend, you want to have a quiet weekend at home with your family.
A lot of football this weekend, Carl.
Bill, if you ever need anything in, from, or of New Hampshire, I'm your guy. Bill O'Reilly with us at 1590 WSMN. I owe you a favor. I'll send you the cash if you'd rather.
Okay, no, no. You did a great job with Jessica's Law, Carl. So.
Well, and I got more stuff. I'll be in touch with Porter in a couple
right,
weeks.
It's a pleasure to talk to you about anything.
Right
Thank
back you. At you, Bill. Thanks, man. And welcome back to Crosswinds with Carl Zahn at 1590 WSMN. Want to remind everybody that podcasts of this show are available at carlfromnh.com, and that's Carl with a K. Also want to remind everybody that this week, this month, the Hippo Awards. If you go to hippopress.com, HIPPOPRESS.com, you can vote on everything from New Hampshire's best restaurants to the best barbers to the best nightclubs and, of course, the best radio station and show. You can make your own decision on the show, but we certainly want you to vote for WSMN and WGAM.
We have a lot of a lot of good hosts and a lot of good shows, a lot of good programming here on WSMN, and
of course,
WGAM, the game with the sports side of it. So you got to make sure you get your votes in. Click, click, click.
That's right. Click, click, click. You just go. You can do it all online. It takes only a few minutes. I voted for myself several hundred times last night, and so it's immensely easy to do. Before we go any further, just a couple days ago, I was able to have a chat with former governor, Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, about the McCain campaign, and here's how that went. I'm joined on the phone today by former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift. Governor, thank you for joining us on Crosswinds at 1590 WSMN in Nashua. First, I want to thank you for your support of Senator McCain and for your wonderful piece in the Union Leader a month or so ago. And don't you think this comeback story is just an epic comeback?
It is unbelievable that Senator McCain, fueled really by the big win in New Hampshire and the wisdom of the New Hampshire Republican primary voters, is now on the verge of being able to wrap up the nomination for the presidency. He has done an outstanding job in South Carolina and more recently in Florida. He's beginning to get big endorsements from Governor Schwarzenegger in California and certainly Governor Perry in Texas today. So I guess all of us who are in New Hampshire this summer when things looked bleak are probably a little surprised, although we'll all say we knew it was going to happen.
My biggest fear for him right now is that he may drown in his own endorsements, because there's so many of them. And I will say that I was on the air all summer and literally getting laughed at when they wrote him off, and I said, he's not done, because I was at his first town hall meeting in March last year in New Hampshire, and I could tell then, and I've been fascinated with McCain for a long time, since before 2000. I knew that he would cover this state on a bicycle with a cup full of coins if he had to.
I really think that the mental toughness that Senator McCain exhibited really does speak volumes about the person, and we shouldn't be surprised based on the long service he's had to his country and really the passion he feels for making sure that our country remains strong and safe. I am just incredibly honored to be one of his supporters, and I know that he will help turn our economy around, he'll help improve our public schools, and most importantly, he'll keep us safe from the global threat of terrorism.
Yeah, I think he will probably be one of the best presidents the country's ever had. Now, this shootout with Romney last night was stunning. And I have to tell you, to listen to Romney lament his lack of rebuttal time in Florida to the timetable charge and calling it reprehensible and a dirty trick struck me as a little disingenuous when Romney did the same thing to McCain up here in New Hampshire, you know, with this onslaught of ads, taking bits and pieces out of context from McCain's immigration bill and crafting a completely misleading and negative ad just days before the New Hampshire primary.
You know, it really is amazing that Mitt Romney would be upset about the tactics in a campaign at this point. He outspent, I was just in Florida, and there was a very tough race down there. Mitt Romney put more attack ads on the air in September than John McCain put ads on the air in Florida in the entire month of January. So certainly Senator McCain has been underfunded, has not been able to match the ad buy. But as I said when I was in New Hampshire, you know, the voters are smart. They look at the records. They look at, take the measure of the man, and they figure out who they want to lead them going into the future. And on those measures, Senator McCain has fared very well.
Absolutely. And there's something about McCain, out of all these people that I dragged to town hall meetings all summer up here in New Hampshire, and a lot of them weren't interested. And I said, and I put it to them as, you know, come meet an American hero, politics aside. And if you can just get people to meet John and listen to him in person, every single person that I did that with left as a supporter. And now, and how do you explain the level of vitriol towards McCain from the far right that we're hearing now? I mean, we've had two reports of people actually spontaneous human combustion. You know, they just exploded into flames.
Well, you know, I think that people get very passionate about politics. And certainly when you have someone like Senator McCain, who isn't wishy-washy, who will stand up for his convictions, who's willing to break with his party when he believes that the party is wrong. He puts America first, and I think that's why ultimately he'll be elected president, and he's probably the only Republican in this climate who could get elected president. But I do believe the conservative talk radio folks are mad that they can't control John McCain, but he shares many of their principles. He has a great conservative voting record. I told somebody, you know, my biggest hesitation in supporting the senator early on was that he was too conservative. So I'm not sure all what lies behind some of this, but I think people will very quickly rally around Senator McCain as it becomes increasingly obvious that he is the nominee of our party and that he's our best chance to beat the Democrats in November. The stakes are very high.
I think so, too, but it's just an interesting phenomenon. I had the good fortune just a couple weeks ago of speaking with Bill O'Reilly about it, and at that time I asked him, do you think the party will unite behind McCain? And he goes, well, they're not going to stay home. They're not going to cross over. But if you listen to talk radio today in the wake of last night in the Florida win, lots of people are saying that, which I find to be just an immensely childish and selfish response. I can only hope it's going to wear off.
Yeah, you know, I think that Senator McCain has proven an ability to win folks over who didn't think they were going to vote for him. Certainly did that in New Hampshire, and I have great confidence in his abilities as our nominee. Once we, you know, continue marching forward through Super Tuesday, which is incredibly important, almost as important as who wins the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
But I do believe that Senator McCain will win folks over with his tenacity, his passion, his service to our country, and really his good intentions to lead us forward.
I certainly hope so. I mean, like you, I'm sure I've read all his books, and I just find him to be a remarkable man. And to finish up here, and this is on a completely unrelated subject, our mutual friends from that other station in Boston, Jim and Marjorie.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, Marjorie is just a sweetheart, and I love her to death. But have you noticed some changes with Jim and this anchorman complex of his?
You know what? I have missed that, but I have been in Florida campaigning, so I'll have to catch up and see if is Jim getting a little too big for his britches.
Well, I'm sure that I'm going to point out this interview to him, and maybe he'll be able to comment on it himself. It's kind of an anchor man, a Will Ferrell fire in my loins type of thing going on there.
Well, I'll have to check that out.
Okay. Governor Jane Swift, thank you so much for joining us at 1590 WSMN in Nashua. Please give my best to the senator when you see him. He does know me. And let's just hope for a big, big day on Tuesday.
Absolutely. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you, Jane. And there you go. That was our interview with Jane Swift, who was right in the thick of the McCain win down there in Florida, which was huge. When we come back, we'll be doing our Call Me a Nut segment, the Dirty Rotten News of the Week. And also quickly on the political scene this week, since last we met here last Sunday, the endorsement of Barack Obama by Ted and Caroline Kennedy must have had Hillary foaming at the mouth like a rabid ferret. The National Organization of Women released a scathing scathing statement aimed at the Kennedys for abandoning Hillary. So, you know, things are really heating up in this presidential race. Both sides are really fractured. McCain is sending fractures through the Republican side because the far, far right just does not like him. And the Democratic side is really split between Clinton's and the fresh, the new Barack Obama. So it just it gets more and more interesting. Everything comes across Tuesday. It's very interesting. And watching the Clintons go into destroy mode, Hillary has gone from weeping in New Hampshire on election eve to seeming like Linda Blair in The Exorcist at the first Democratic debate, and then transforming yet again into a lovable little furry bunny during Thursday night's debate with Barack Obama, where they were just so sweet to each other. It almost made me cry. It's 1590 Crosswinds, WSMN, Nashua's News and Talk. Right back for Call Me a Nut. Joining us on the air today at 1590 WSMN is the legendary newsman Dan Rather. Mr. Rather, I am eternally grateful for the opportunity, particularly on the very day that may well mark a turning point in American history. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, Carl, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. I get my audience up to speed here. Now, you and I first met almost a year ago on April 25th, 2007, the day that John McCain officially announced his candidacy in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I had the honor of being included in a fireside political chat with you and four other New Hampshire voters. As I look back on that now, none of us, I think, could have predicted the roller coaster ride that lay ahead in what has been an absolutely fascinating primary campaign, the hallmarks of which have been, among other things, McCain's comeback and Obama's meteoric rise.
Absolutely right, Carl. But, you know, I hope on my better days I'm at least a half-decent reporter about what has happened and what is happening. But the record shows I'm not very good at predicting what's going to happen, that my crystal ball is therefore almost permanently in the hawk shop. But this has been an extraordinary year. You used the word historic a few moments ago, and it's already an historic campaign, and we're not even to the general election yet for all kinds of reasons. The first genuinely viable woman making a real bid to become a major party's nominee, the first person of African-American descent to do so. This campaign has already spent more money than any in history, and before we finish, it'll be close to a $2 billion presidential campaign. So what a historic year it has been, and you also used the phrase roller coaster, which I like. What a roller coaster ride. I remember being in New Hampshire and seeing you in New Hampshire when everybody you met said it's Obama because he'd won in Iowa, and the assumption was, and the polls all indicated, he was going to sweep New Hampshire. Well, the roller coaster went up for him, and then it came down after New Hampshire, and then he got to South Carolina, and the rest is history. And here we are on a day where Senator Clinton has, in my judgment, absolutely must-win situation with either Texas or Ohio, and frankly, she probably has to win both, but she certainly has to win one. And Senator Obama, who's been on the proverbial hot streak for the last 11 times, that includes caucuses, where it's quite a bit different than primary voting, of course, suddenly has run into some negative things for his campaign. The talk that his aide had with Canadians about wink, wink, don't worry what we're saying about NAFTA, the trial of one of his supporters in Chicago on some very serious charges.
Yeah, the Tony Resco thing.
You know, I'm not saying any of that is justified, but it's politics, and politics is not only a contact sport, but in some cases a blood sport. So here we are, and I just find myself, I'm having a 3,000-calorie attack every 2 hours waiting for these returns tonight.
You and me both. And I think one of the amazing thing about Obama, the fact that he has overcome the all-powerful Clinton machine, I likened it a few days ago to the Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner cartoon. you know, Obama is kind of like beep, beep, and Hillary keeps pulling out all the, you know, the painted tunnel entrance on the side of a mountain. It's just been fascinating. But I sense that, and I think it's demonstrated in Obama's popularity, there is this hunger for change. It's as though the country is an exhausted spouse coming out of an 8-year abusive relationship, and we just want anything other than what we've had.
Well, there certainly is a strong feeling of that, which is fueling, in large part, the what some people call Obama mania, a bandwagon, but more accurately put, I think, a movement. And what Senator Clinton has attempted to do, particularly in the latter stages of this incredible fight they've had of a campaign, that she's tried to point out, you know, change, but what kind of change? And if it has taken traction at all, it's only begun to take traction in the last, certainly week or 10 days, maybe last few days, and we'll see whether it comes too late. But you do have to give Senator Obama plenty of credit, not just because he came out of nowhere and established himself as a substantial candidate, perhaps a winning candidate, but he's put together the kind of campaign operation that nobody, and I mean Republican, Democrat, or Independent, or Mugwump, thought was possible to equal or better the Clinton campaign machinery. And he's put together something that, in political terms, is almost awe-inspiring, for the fact that it's so well organized and that it operates in a timely manner. And, you know, that speaks well for his organizational abilities and maybe another reason some people are saying, well, look, he's new, he's fresh, he may be untested in some ways, but he's demonstrated that he has real organizational talent.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Dan Rather, and you can see him regularly on Dan Rather Reports on HDNet. Dan, as you know, I am a McCain supporter, but he is worrying me as I see him trying to appease the lunatic right. And he disappointed me, and I think he is jeopardizing the very thing that makes him appealing, i.e., his refusal to compromise his beliefs, I think, is to some degree evanescing before our eyes.
This is such an interesting point, Carl. And I do remember that you're a McCain man from way back.
Yes.
And, you know, let me state for transparency that I've known Senator McCain for a long time. And whatever anybody thinks about him, that he has been an independent thinker. And I think that's one of the things that have attracted a lot of people who might not normally vote Republican to at least consider him. I'll tell you frankly, I don't understand what's happened in particularly these last few days where he took the support of this preacher who said that Katrina was God's wrath because New Orleans was filled with gays, said bad things about the Catholic Church. It seemed, from the outside, it seemed an easy call for Senator McCain.
Absolutely.
Particularly given where he has positioned himself, that is, as independent. Yes, he says, I vote Republican, I vote strongly Republican when I can, but independent. I don't understand it. I don't get it.
I don't either, Dan, and I think I have to say I was very disappointed on his reversal on the torture vote, which, you know, he gave this very compelling speech in one of the debates with Mitt Romney about why this is such an important American ideal. It's so important for us to not cross this line, and I think that is clearly an effort to appease, you know, the Rush Limbaughs and the Ann Coulters, and I really think that he's making a mistake. And you mentioned Hurricane Katrina. I was going to ask you, getting off of politics for a moment, you were the first one to break the story almost a year ago of the FEMA formaldehyde trailers that were sent to house victims of Hurricane Katrina. You did a very compelling piece on it, and only now is the mainstream media picking up on it. I bring this up because I hear nothing from any of the presidential candidates about our dismal failure in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, how we would prevent that lack of response from happening again, and a host of other issues that I feel are very pressing. Our national infrastructure is decaying and nearly obsolete. Our education system is failing our children. The demise of the family structure, violence that is increasing in intensity and volume, the internet marketing of our children as sexual toys, so many things in play, and yet nearly no mention of them. It's the economy, the war, and health care. How do you see it?
I think you said it very well, and that is, it's a mystery to me why each and every one of those things you mentioned, I would say particularly the Katrina thing, which was a national embarrassment the way we handled it.
Absolutely.
And remains an outrage. Tonight on HDNet, we're doing a follow-up on our continuing reports about leaving these people in these formaldehyde ridden trailers, the squelching of people at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention who tried to raise warnings about this, and FEMA just didn't want to hear it, tried to keep it from the public and, more important, keep it from those people's trailers. At any rate, I have that on the mind because we have a follow-up on it on our program tonight. But to your point, each of those things you mentioned, I listened to, I believe, 17 debates. There have been more than that, as you know, but I've listened to 17 debates and said to myself a number of times, why aren't they talking about schools and what's happening with the schools? Because this is something that an overwhelming majority of Americans can relate to. The crumbling infrastructure, huge problem in the country.
Absolutely.
And President Eisenhower, during his presidency, got high marks at the time, and in the rethinking the Eisenhower presidency in fairly recent years, it's given him high credit for building the infrastructure. Now we're letting it all go to hell in a hack. There's so many things that they aren't addressing. You ticked off a lot. One of my favorites is, you know, they talk about Iraq and Afghanistan, which are really important because we have our blood and our treasure invested there. But nobody talks about Russia and the reemergence of Russia as both an economic power and striving to become once again a preeminent military power. There are a lot of things that they could talk about that I do think would connect with the public, and it just remains a puzzle to me why they stay on. For example, health care is certainly important, but the last two, and I think three, Democratic debates have started off with about 20 minutes on health care, at the expense of these other things that you mentioned.
That's kind of how I feel about it. I agree with you completely. I mean, healthcare may become a redundant issue if we don't get some of these other issues under control. Listen, Dan, I know you're very busy. I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us, and I recommend to my audience the book Lone Star, which I'm about halfway through, a very compelling account of a remarkable life and career that started, as I understand it, in radio at KTRH in Houston around 1955.
Carl, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And once we get through this this part of the political season, let's talk again.
I hope you'll stay in touch. You're truly a remarkable man, and I'm truly grateful for having had the opportunity to share your company and conversation. I hope you'll stay in touch, and I urge our listeners to check out Dan Rather Reports on HDNet and also from one of my favorite states, Texas. Really appreciate you being with us, Dan.
Indeed, it will. Stay in touch, Carl. Godspeed.
Lynch. I hold you in high regard, especially for your efforts in the child protection arena. For our listeners who may not know, you and your staff were instrumental in bringing forth the New Hampshire Child Protection Act, which went into effect on January 1st, 2007, and consequently gave New Hampshire some of the toughest laws against child predators in the country. I know there were a few weak spots that caused some concern, but I noticed the first few cases to be tried under the new law have indeed brought the heavy sentences that the law intended. Our no-nonsense judges given due credit. Now, I understand you and Attorney General Kelly Ayotte are at it again. Could you tell us about the legislation you are working on aimed at child pornography on the Internet?
Well, thank you, Carl. And thank you, Carl, for all that you have done as well, because you've done, I think, quite a lot to focus all of our attention on these important issues. As we've talked, Carl, I think people who prey on our kids are the most dangerous criminals in our state. They target our most precious and our most vulnerable citizens. And I think now we must modernize our laws to protect our children from the threats of the 21st century. Technology is changing our world in so many ways, mostly for the better. Unfortunately, technology also makes it easier for criminals to sneak into our homes, and we must ensure that our laws are protecting our kids from threats posed by today's technological world. Now, in the United States, Carl, more than 60% of 10-year-olds and 80% of teenagers 15 to 17 use the Internet. Here in New Hampshire, I regularly meet with fourth graders, Carl, who come to the State House as part of their fourth grade educational experience, and just about all of them are using the Internet.
Yep.
According to research conducted at the University of New Hampshire, more than one-third of youth Internet users are communicating online with someone they don't know. And this is a startling statistic as well, Carl. Approximately 1 in 7 youth Internet users receives unwanted sexual solicitations over the Internet.
Isn't that alarming?
It is incredibly alarming, and it's disgusting.
It is.
And in more than half of these solicitations, these kids were asked for photographs of themselves, and most of these children were also asked by these adults to meet in person. So I've worked very closely with Attorney General Kelly Ayotte, New Hampshire's law enforcement community, to review our state laws and to propose enhancing them to protect our kids on the Internet. It's clear that these laws are outdated and insufficient in many respects. The bill that we're proposing, Carl, strengthens the penalties in existing law for enticing a child over the Internet and provides enhanced penalties for repeat offenders. We're also overhauling and expanding our child pornography laws to really better reflect the victimization that occurs every day when images of sexually abused kids are created and distributed. And finally, this legislation closes some loopholes so that sex offenders using webcams can be held accountable. It really gives the police the tools that they need to take these sexual predators, consistent with the Sexual Predator Act that you talked about, and bring them to justice.
Well, I think it's a fantastic effort, and my understanding is that should this legislation go forth and become law, that it would be some of the toughest of its nature in the country. Is that correct?
It absolutely is correct, and I think it would set the model for other states to follow as well, Carl.
I hope so. Now, Governor, I'm sure you're aware, just days ago, and I'll go through this quickly, 12 Americans were indicted in a global child pornography ring. One member that was arrested, James Freeman, had said to his cohorts on this site that all I can say of these pictures is that they are worth the download. And he said, my thanks to you and all the others that together make this the greatest group of pedos ever to gather in one place. This is so alarming, Governor. FBI Executive Assistant Stephen Tidwell said, this is beyond a quantum exponential leap for us to see folks that have gone to this much trouble to produce this kind of volume of horrific exploitation of children. So far, Tidwell said, authorities have identified and rescued, imagine this, John, 20 of the children who were exploited. And he said that with 400,000 images brought in with just this one sting, he said, we're going to be at this for years trying to find these victims. Isn't that just heartbreaking?
It is heartbreaking. And you know what, Carl, as you and I have talked about, I mean, it not only hurts these kids today, but it really ruins them in some cases for the rest of their lives. So their childhood has been taken away from them. And I just find the people who do this disgusting. And I am going to work as hard as I can, like I did before, to put in place these tough penalties.
Well, I know that you have in the past, and I know you will in the future, and I applaud Kelly Ayotte's efforts. You know, when we went through this, you know, we started a citizens campaign and got signatures, and really, I mean, I did the least of anybody. I mean, there was you, Kelly Ayotte, Bill Wren, State Rep Peter, you know, Peter Batula, too many names to list of people who really did the heavy lifting to bring this law forth. But one of the things that struck me, Governor, kind of watching it go through the process, was the amount of opposition that the New Hampshire Child Predator Act law met with. Are you finding that this time around?
Not so far. You know, it still has a way to go in the legislative process. You know, and sometimes people, I think, want to be, you know, too sympathetic to some of the perpetrators. And I'd have no sympathy for them at all. I think what they are doing to our kids and what they have done is atrocious, appalling, and disgusting.
Well,
and I think we should be tough with them.
I agree with you. And listen, I really give you credit for getting out front on this. I think one of the impediments in dealing with this is simply how awkward and uncomfortable it is for most people to think about it, let alone to try to discuss it. I notice even in the presidential arena, it's almost a taboo subject, but I feel that it is really a plague that is sweeping the country. And in spite of the tougher sentences that, say, the New Hampshire Child Protection Act, Jessica's Law brings forth, my gut instinct tells me we're creating, or the Internet, I should say, is creating or manufacturing these pedophiles at a quicker rate than we're going to be able to eventually deal with them through the justice system. Do you feel that?
Well, I do think the technology is changing in such a way it's becoming increasingly difficult for the state and, Carl, for parents, not only to provide the oversight, but to, you know, put in place and to get these perpetrators to justice. You know, it used to be that parents could, you know, kind of look over their kid's shoulder as the kid was on the computer using the Internet in the kitchen. And now, given technology, you know, the children can access the Internet while they're on the bus or in the playground
everywhere,
or in the parks.
Yeah,
and it's becoming much more difficult to provide that parental oversight that they used to be able to exercise in the past.
It absolutely is, and I think you're seeing, and I'm sure you agree, that this kind of sexualization of our children, it's just spilling over into general media, really, now. Even some of the TV commercials on children's programming is dubious. But to end on a lighter note, and just here's a couple of the reasons for our listeners here, and we're speaking with Governor John Lynch at 1590 WSMN. A couple of the reasons I think so much of you, Governor, during the devastating flood a few years ago in Allstead, and Governor Lynch had given his personal cell phone number out to residents up there. You can't get any more down to earth than that. And if that wasn't enough, on January 8th, Governor, when you and I first discussed the possibility of this interview, I had mentioned to you that my son's fourth grade class had been to a field trip at the State House that day, and they were disappointed because Governor Lynch wasn't there as usual for his group photo. And Governor, what did you offer to do for my children that day?
I offered to give him a call.
And you did indeed, yeah. Governor Lynch, to try to make up and assuage his own guilt, called my two children at home, who suddenly became quiet and demure, more so than I have seen them since or prior to that phone call. Governor John Lynch, it's been a pleasure having you with us. I wish you the best of luck. Now, I understand there's some kind of hearing on this legislation coming up on Monday.
That's correct, and I'll be testifying in favor of it. And let me also, again, Carl, I mean, I know you know, a very humble person, but you've done a lot as well, and I think we all just need to work together, all of us, to do everything we can to protect our children in New Hampshire.
Well, I agree with you completely, and if we can't all find a bipartisan cause in this particular issue, then I can't imagine one that would bring us together. John, thanks again so much, and have a good weekend.
Thank you, Carl. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for giving us the time, sir.
Bye.
Joining us on the air today at 1590 WSMN is Janine Turner, actress and now author. You're here to talk about your new book, Holding Her Head High, 12 Single Mothers Who Championed Their Children and Changed History. Now, Janine, to get my audience up to speed, which is always a daunting task, by the way. You may know Janine from her portrayal of Maggie O'Connell in the Emmy Award-winning CBS series Northern Exposure. She also starred in the Lifetime series Strong Medicine. She recently produced and directed the short film Trip in a Summer Dress, which also starred her young daughter, Juliet. She won Best Director for this film at the Deep Ellum Film Festival and currently stars in the Lifetime film Primal Doubt. Janine, before we talk about your book, I understand you are a native Texan, and tell me a little bit about your own childhood and how it shaped you, and was faith an integral part of your upbringing?
I am a Texan. You know, we Texans are pretty obnoxious. We think Texas is just sort of it. But I love Boston, by the way, and I really want to come visit Boston.
Boston's
I'm a revolutionary
a great town.
Buff.
Yeah.
And I have Abigail Adams in my book, which we'll circle back to. But,
I noticed that, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was raised in Texas. My father flew in the Air Force and was one of the first to fly twice the speed of sound in the 1960s. And my mother was in real estate, and mom's from San Antonio. My dad's from Athens, Texas. And, you know, back then it was wild prairies, and, you know, you open the school door and there was a cow. I mean, it was a lot of fun. And but we had some cosmopolitan aspects, too. I modeled in Dallas and worked and whatnot. But I don't know. It's really hard to describe the essence of Texas, but it's just
well, you know
a
what?
Place to grow up.
You're leading me into one of my other comments I had. And if I were to leave my native New Hampshire, it would be for either Texas or Arizona. And there's a song by Robert Keane that was performed by Lyle Lovett called This Old Porch. And I think, to me, it says everything about the old-school Texas culture and kind of reinforces my Texas fantasy. I just think
well,
it's
know,
a great
I have
state.
A ranch. I have a ranch with longhorn cattle and horses, and I do have a porch, and that's just really where I want to be, you know, and it's hard to leave it. And I'm a terrible cattle woman because I refuse to let anybody buy them for beef, and they have to be pets, and they can't go to the rodeo.
Oh, my goodness. Well, cattle.
I named them all.
Cattle is pets. You know, you would fit right in New Hampshire, let me tell you, my dear.
Well, I know. It's really tough. We named them interesting names like Prairie Blossom and Liberty and Revolution and America's Pride. How do you spell and eat a cow like that, you know?
Well, there you go. And you mentioned your dad's a pilot, and you played a pilot, I believe, in Northern Exposure. I'm a pilot myself, so you've piqued my interest. Do you fly?
No, I don't. But I would like to, because, you know, flying sometimes freaks me out, and I realize one of the reasons it does is because I'm not in control.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, maybe if I learned how to fly, I would understand why they go from where they slow down so much after they take off. I'm like, what's that all about? What's going on?
Well, your dad probably, you must have a little bit of aviation in your blood there. But
I do, and I have to be brave because I'm a pilot's daughter and I've played one on TV. So.
Well, if you got your license, you'd be in complete control. It would be right up your alley then.
Yeah, exactly.
We better talk about your book or we're going to run out of time here.
I know.
Listen, you've chosen an eclectic group of women for your book from a variety of time periods as well. Women like Rachel Levine Fawcett, the abandoned single mother of Alexander Hamilton. I got to tell you, I was fascinated by this stuff just looking through it. Harriet Jacobs, an unwed mother whose autobiography was published the year the Civil War began. What made you decide to examine such a broad landscape of time in choosing the women you were going to write about?
Well, they just sort of popped off the pages when I was researching, because first of all, I was amazed there were so many.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what I realized, as I said, you know, the definition is just so broad of a single mother. It can mean widowed or divorced or abandoned or by choice. And the women in this book kind of have the gamut. They sort of are all different sorts of categories. And I'm fascinated by history, and I love every aspect of it. And so I went as far back as I could. So the first woman is from the Roman Empire, Helena Augusta, in the 3rd century. And then I have 2 medieval women, 5 revolutionary women, 2 slaves, a pioneer woman who was one of the first women to homestead, and the first woman to run for president. So it's kind of a wide variety. But what was interesting is even though the playing fields of history were so diverse, their message was so modern in the respect that you know, pain and joy and love and happiness and despair and sickness and death, all these things are eternal. That it doesn't really matter, you know, what age. And I just kind of became friends with them all. I laughed at them and cried with them and rallied them to victory. And they didn't just champion their children through really devastating times. They had to just pull themselves up and make these choices. Okay, do I give in to defeat or do I persevere? And I have 12 life lessons that sort of coincide with all of their journeys, like don't give up before the miracle and dare to dream and define your own destiny and whatnot.
Yeah, it's an amazing, I'll tell you, because I think we kind of tend to think of single mother and single motherhood as being something of the last several decades and kind of the modern era, and you don't think of how it has, as you've demonstrated here, it's been all through history, and that common thread, as you pointed out, of perseverance. I mean, one could make the argument that there were much tougher obstacles to overcome back then, but on the other hand, raising a child in today's world is not, there's no shortage of obstacles here either. We're speaking with actress and now author Janine Turnit discussing her new book, Holding Her Head High. Janine, a key word in the title of your book, champion, mothers who championed their children. You know, we need more champions for children in American society today. Now more than ever, we need to evaluate our treatment of our most valuable and precious resource, our children. You know, it sounds trite, it's oversaid, but they really are our future. Isn't it? It's a dangerous world for kids today.
It is a dangerous world, and as you said, there were dangers back then, and there are dangers today, and in that respect, the emotions are the same, and I think that if this book can inspire the mothers that to cope through the difficult times and to make wise choices, you know, to not give up before the miracle, and to know that there will be one, and to because I think that when our children see us persevere with dignity, that's a big message for them. And when they see us make wise choices and strong choices, even though they're hard and maybe not the easiest ones, that's inspiration to them. And they're little miniature replicants of us, you know. And so if the mother can be inspired, then hopefully, you know, they will inspire their children to make wise decisions. They can look back and like, look what my mom did through these times, and if she can do it, I can do it. And for the mother, she can look what our foremothers did in these books.
Well, I think
and say, wow.
Yeah, you really hit on another key word there, dignity, which is, you know, a quality I think that we see less and less of in modern society, and it was surely prevalent back in some of these women, the times that you wrote about. It's interesting you talk about being a parent, and I'm a parent. I always feel like parents are kind of members of a secret club. You know, I watch some of my favorite comedians became parents, Jerry Seinfeld, Dana Carvey, Dennis Miller, and David Letterman, who's gushing over his son Harry, was almost uncontrollable. Mm-hmm. But until you become a parent, you really don't, I mean, you really learn what unconditional love is when you become a parent, don't you?
Yeah. Yo, absolutely. And my little girl's 10, and she's my blessing from God, and you know, I put God first, but my daughter's, you know, first in my life here on this earthly world, and all my decisions are based on what's best for her. And I think that's what makes it so difficult for parents or mothers or single mothers is trying to blend, being a working parent and doing what's best for our children. I think there's such guilt associated with it. At least there has been for me. I mean, I was like, oh, you know, I can't leave. I have to make sure she stays in school.
Sure.
This is,
yeah.
And my job is so transient, you know, that we go from place to place. And what I learned from these women is like, wait, because, you know, working mother, you think, oh, that's a modern day phenomenon. Well, these women were working back then.
Sure.
Whether they were school teachers or princesses or queens or professional writers, and they all worked hard, and they had to work. If they're a pioneer woman churning the butter and plucking the chickens and gathering the water and, you know,
washing
the clothes with a stone.
Right, exactly. Working. Yeah, it kind of makes life look today, you know, today's life look a little easier. But, you know, interestingly, we have in the national spotlight right now the son of a single mother, Barack Obama, who has demonstrated what one can build on a strong foundation and that foundation can be provided by a single mother. And I give you credit. Obviously, you were given a strong foundation from your parents. you've passed it on. I really think that that is key to raising children successfully, whether it's a single parent home or not.
Well, faith has been a big part of my, has been a big part of my foundation. I don't know what I'd do without that, and,
yeah.
and also communication. I think if, you know, those are my rocks, and with my daughter, I've just always communicated with her and kept it open and express your feelings, let me know how you're feeling and how can we help this and get through this, and if you don't tell me your thoughts, I can't, you know, help you.
Right.
So I think that I learned that from my parents, and my faith is everything to me, so hopefully, you know, based on those things.
Sure.
And I like to say in my book, you know, God sees eternity in perspective.
Yeah.
So that when we don't always understand everything that's going on, just, you know, kind of hang on, and then the light bulb will go off. You go, oh, I get it now.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it is a cornerstone, no doubt about it. I give you credit for tackling a somewhat taboo subject with an optimistic and hopeful perspective. You can learn more about Janine and her book at JanineTurner.com. Also, you recently starred with Tom Wilkinson in the movie Night of the White Pants, which sounds like an account of my senior prom, by the way.
Funny screenplay. It took place in Dallas.
I can't wait to see that.
He's a wonderful actor.
You know what? I was going to say, I first saw Tom Wilkinson in the movie In the Bedroom with Sissy Spacek,
mm-hmm.
a harrowing account of a main couple that loses their son to violence. And I think Tom Wilkinson probably one of the most underrated actors coming around in a modern age. I found him to be just stunning. So I'll be interesting to see how you two work together in Night of the White Pants, Janine.
Yeah. I was his crazy second wife.
Oh boy. Well, there's something to look forward to. Listen, Janine, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope you'll stay in touch. We're going to give your book all the promotion that we can. You've had a remarkable career. You're a remarkable woman. Good luck to you and your daughter, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it so
you
much.
You bet. My pleasure. We'll talk to you soon.